And we are ready to go.
I want to introduce to you this morning, Ken White. Ken White is a pastor. He has served at several churches in the Presbyterian Church around Pittsburgh. Most recently, he served at Southminster as one of their associates. In his capacity there, I got to know Ken a little better as he was facilitating and leading different pilgrimages. And he was able to take a group from the South Hills I shared with you last week over on this wonderful pilgrimage to Scotland. But he also has led other groups to various places around the world. And he's going to share that with us today. Ken actually lives out in Murraysville, but we are delighted that he could be with us today via Zoom. And one of the things that delights me in introducing Ken today is that when he goes on these travels, he truly makes them a pilgrimage so that we go out and experience God's world. He's a wonderful storyteller. So he invokes these wonderful stories of faith as he takes us to different places. And he really draws us closer to God as he draws the group closer to one another. So I'm delighted that he could be with us today. And now I'll turn things over to Ken and allow him to tell us of his accounts of pilgrimages and travels and of his faith of God to share with us today. Thank you, Ken.
Thanks, Louise. It is a pleasure to be with you this morning during this time of COVID and isolation. It's nice to be in connection with others. I retired 5 years ago after nearly 40 years in ministry, serving in the Presbyterian Church. And I believe today to be true what I did all those years, that we are always better together than we are apart. And one of the things I value about being a Presbyterian is that we are a connectional church. In my years at Southminster Presbyterian Church, I was in close proximity to the Westminster Presbyterian Church. But early on, I served two other congregations, the Thomas Presbyterian Church in Washington Presbytery and the Newlandsburg Presbyterian Church in Redstone Presbytery. And in 1997, I believe it was, Westminster Presbyterian Church, Thomas Presbyterian Church, and Newlandsburg Presbyterian Church worked together to build a clinic at the La Croix New Testament Mission in Haiti. And I have a vivid memory image in my mind of a sign by a well that was installed there with the inscription, Thomas Westminster Newlandsburg. So as I come to you today as a guest lecturer, I also come as someone who has some practical and personal experience of being in ministry with the Westminster Presbyterian Church, and very, very grateful for that. When Louise invited me to these 2 weeks, I laid out a plan for the 3 weeks where I would give an introduction to pilgrimage and then a reflection on some experiences of pilgrimage, and Louise was going to have the third week. Well, as it turned out, Louise had to go first, and I'm unaware of what Louise shared with you last week. I apologize if there's some repetition this week for things that she had covered last week. But to begin our discussion today of pilgrimage, I want to take us back to the beginning. And by that, I mean the very, very beginning. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. But the ruach, the wind of God, blew across the deep. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. Scripture tells us that at the very beginning of time, God acted to bring order out of chaos. The Hebrew word for what the world looked like at that time is tohu wabohu. And there are some words that sound like what they mean, like the word squish sounds like what squish means. And tohu wabohu, the earth was a formless void. But into that chaos, God brought order. And as the story unfolds, God continues to separate and to populate, to separate light from darkness and waters from waters and land from waters, to populate with moon and stars and the sun, the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, everything that moves upon the face of the land. And then into this ordered world, God brought humanity created in the very image of God and gifted us this world of beauty and order. And God looked around and said, "This is very good." But it wasn't very long, as the story tells us, that our contribution to God's ordered creation was to bring chaos and disharmony. And we remember the stories of Adam and Eve and of Cain and Abel. We remember the story of Noah and the ark and the world washed clean. And we remember the story of the Tower of Babel and how in all of these instances, through disobedience and jealousy and pride and arrogance, chaos began to reign again in God's ordered world. But God wasn't finished. And God began to start again to bring order into the chaos of the world and to bring salvation to humanity and to the world. And that salvation story begins with a man named Abraham, who was invited by God to go on a God-centered journey. And God said to Abraham, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you, and your name will be great. And I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And all of the families of the world will be blessed through you." God's reordering of creation begins with a story of a man who was sent on a God-centered journey. And really, that's what pilgrimage is all about, God-centered journey. And we see in scripture over and over again that all God's children have traveling shoes, as the poet Maya Angelou titled one of her books. We see it in the Exodus, and we see it in the stories of Jesus and his disciples. We see it in the ministry of Paul and the apostles. And we remember how it was that Jesus commissioned all of us with the invitation to a journey to be his witnesses in Jerusalem, in Judea, in Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. It seems that God is inviting us on journeys in this life, and they usually begin right where we are. Might not be Jerusalem for us. It might be Upper St. Clair or Murraysville, wherever we find ourselves. But God is always inviting us to go a little further than just right where we are. And he invites us into the experience of going into the Judeas of our life and our experience as well, to reach out and stretch and go a little bit further. But there are also times that he calls us to journey, not just geographically. Even though Samaria was the region next to Judea to travel to Samaria means to cross the boundaries of our ignorance and our prejudice. It's a journey in the heart as much as it is a journey of geography. And then when God invites us to journey to the ends of the earth, you may recall that before the world was fully mapped and known, those unknown regions, those places that were not known or experienced, that were usually labeled with the caption, "Here be giants." And those areas that we are unfamiliar with or we don't know seem to elicit our fear. But nevertheless, God seems to be inviting us into journeys in this life, geographically and spiritually, and all for the purpose of having us experience the salvation that God is bringing into a chaotic and disorganized world. He's inviting us through these experiences of journey with God to know that our God is a God who frees his people, and our God is a God who wants the best for us. So we see in scripture that journey is very much a part of the story of God's people. But I do find it interesting that as much as the stories talk about journeys, now probably for the vast, vast majority of people, they seldom traveled more than a few miles from their home. They lived in a time, in an age of whether you were an emperor and a king or a peasant, you could travel no further than you could walk, or a horse could carry you, or a sail might move you across the waters. Journeys were much more difficult than they are now. And I was remembering in my own family history that my great-grandfather, only three generations removed from myself, who lived in County Down in Northern Ireland, never left the county in his entire life. So actual physical journeys may not have been as prevalent or common previously as they are today with the convenience of automobiles and airplanes. But nevertheless, the image of God's people on a journey is central to our salvation history and understanding God's intention for us. So let's talk a little bit about what a pilgrimage is and what it looks like. A pilgrimage is different from vacation or travel in that it has a purpose. And the purpose is that it is a soulful journey with the intention of encountering or being in the company of God as we travel. And in that regard, a pilgrimage may be more rigorous than vacation or other travel, even if it's adventure travel, because what we are invited to do is to come into the presence of the living God. And we find again and again that when people come into God's presence, it is an awe-inspiring experience. It's the mysterium tremendum. It can bring about a sense of trembling as much as anything else. So a pilgrimage starts out by being a soulful journey for the purpose of encountering or accompanying God. The other thing about a pilgrimage is that a pilgrimage is sacred. And the word sacred comes from the origin in sacrifice. So whenever we are on a pilgrimage, there is some sense of sacrifice that is being made. A sacrifice of time, a sacrament of energy, a sacrifice of finance and treasure and even talent as well. But then the other thing we need to remember about pilgrimage is that it is an act of exploring not just the physical world that is around us, but of exploring the deeper questions and the meanings of our lives. Whether we are consciously aware of it or not, each one of us in life has to give answer to these questions. Who am I? Where did I come from? And where am I going? These are the existential questions of life. Perhaps you've heard a description when asking about where in life a young man or a young woman might be. The answer might be, oh, they're taking a little bit of time right now to find themselves. And that is a way of expressing that they, whether they know it or not, as they're trying to find themselves, they're trying to answer those questions. Who am I? Where did I come from? And where am I going? Now, in order to answer these questions, there are some advantages that a pilgrimage gives to us in wrestling with these very important questions. And the first thing that a pilgrimage can do is to give us a sense of perspective. There was a Greek mathematician, and his name was Archimedes. And Archimedes once postulated that if he was given a lever, a rope, and a place to stand far enough removed, that he would be able to move the whole world. But the problem was that he didn't have a place to stand far enough removed to put the leverage and to make the motion for the work to happen. Oftentimes in life, the changes that we want to make are sometimes hampered by the fact that we don't have a place to stand far enough away to give us perspective on the things that we need to change or how we might change them. And so one of the things that a pilgrimage does and travel does is that it gives us perspective. It gives us a place to stand removed from the ordinary experiences of life. The other thing that pilgrimage provides us is an opportunity to explore our identity. Who are we? Who are we indeed? And on pilgrimage, one of the things that we become aware of as we are attentive is that we are children of God. We are created in the image of God, that we are named and claimed by God, that we are loved by God, and also that we are commissioned by God. And one of the things that often happens for me in the experience of pilgrimage is I'm traveling with others, and sometimes it's serendipitous and sometimes it's planned, but we remember our baptism. We aren't rebaptism, there is rebaptized. There is only one baptism. But it becomes important that we remember that we are baptized, that we are children of God, we are precious in his sight, and we are beautiful to behold, and that God has called us to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. To have that as a sense of identity goes a long way towards answering those existential questions. Who am I? Where have I come from? Where am I going? Why am I here? And the last part of the advantages of pilgrimage is that it can help us with a sense of our vocation as well. That a pilgrimage is not only a matter of discovering who we are, but also of discovering what it is that God intends for us, what God asks of us. Now, I was laying out those existential questions of where did I come from? Where am I going? Why am I here? And I'm remembering how it was that in the 13th chapter of John tells the story of Jesus sharing the Passover with his disciples. And the gospel writer records what happens in this way. He said, Jesus, knowing that he had come from God and was going to God, got up from the table, took off his robe, tied a towel around his waist, filled a basin, and began to wash the feet of the disciples and to dry them. Knowing that he had come from God, knowing that he was going to God, Jesus demonstrated how it is that we are free then in this life. What are we to be doing with this life? Is to be able to live with humility in sacrificial service of love to others. And as we go about our time on pilgrimage and we begin to keep company with this God and to reflect on the stories, we begin to find ways that we can answer these existential questions of life. And those unanswered questions, those questions left unanswered have great consequence. Those questions answered with gratitude and satisfaction also have great consequences for life. So a pilgrimage is a soulful journey that is sacred and is an act of the heart as well. So when we look back and we think about the experiences of pilgrimages of God's people through time, what we find is that pilgrimage became popular in the early centuries of the church, particularly after Constantine declared Christianity to be the official religion of the empire. His mother, Helen, had gone to the Holy Lands, and there she had collected relics, and there, hearing the stories, began to build churches in the various sites in the Holy Lands that could be visited and remembered, and where worship could take place. And so there is a tradition within Scripture that where a significant event of God's action in the world has taken place, that place is remembered by raising a pile of stones. An Ebenezer is a remembrance pile of stones, so that when we see that pile of stones, we remember what it was that happened in that place. This is a place of significance. Well, I suppose that when Helen was building churches in Jerusalem, it was not unlike piling up stones, though in a much more aesthetic fashion as the churches were built. And even to this day, as you travel to the Holy Land and you see churches, what sets the churches in the Holy Land apart from the United States is that in the United States, you can drive through Upper St. Clair and past the Westminster Presbyterian Church, where the congregation has been gathering and seeking to learn how to be faithful and then being sent out into the world. And it serves the life of the congregation there. And even as you journey further down the road past the Southminster Presbyterian Church or Mount Lebanon or churches of all sorts, that there are homes, the congregations. But in the Holy Land, when you see a church, it's there not to be the home of a congregation, but to be an agent of remembrance, that God did something here in this place that needs to be remembered. So the Church of the Holy Sepulchre at the place of the crucifixion, or the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem where Jesus was born, or the Church of the Pater Noster where Jesus was said to have taught the disciples to pray the Lord's Prayer. When we encounter churches in these places, it's a way of being reminded and remembering what God has done. And so in the early centuries of Christianity, pilgrimages were being taken to Jerusalem and to the Holy Land to go to these sacred sites.
Ken, we have a question from John Hayes.
Yeah, sure.
He asks, is the desire to go home again the desire of pilgrimage?
Is the desire to go home? I'm sorry.
Is the desire to go home again the pilgrimage of a desirer?
Huh.
I'm a little tongue-tied, sorry.
Desire. No.
It's a little challenging for me.
Here's a little quote about pilgrimage. A pilgrimage is travel that transforms us. And a pilgrimage is leaving our normal routine or leaving home, launching out on a journey, but then returning home transformed by the journey. So perhaps if I understand the question, it's not that we leave home and never go back home, but the end of the pilgrimage is not to be staying somewhere else, but it is to be returning home, but having returned to have been transformed by the experience of the journey. I don't know if that answers that question or not.
I'll let John clarify, but I'll just ask, so is the prodigal's return home the end of his pilgrimage, or is that yet another pilgrimage?
Well, so it's interesting, and they may be two different, it might be an apple and an orange that we're talking here, but let me think about this for a moment. Someone has once said that home is where we spend the first part of our life wanting to leave and the rest of our life wanting to return to. So I don't know that for the prodigal son, and by the way, you know, the story of the prodigal son is one of those stories that is just super saturated with revelations of understanding of our situation and God's nature, and such a beautiful and powerful story. But when the prodigal son set out on the journey, it was neither soulful or sacred or an act of the heart, really, if we had premised those as motivations. What he was motivated by was a desire to kick off the limitations and the restraints. The other thing that is interesting about the story of the prodigal son is that, you know, when we read the story, it says that he took his inheritance and he traveled to the far country. But the far country was on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. He had come from the west side of the Sea of Galilee. And the difference was that the west side of the Sea of Galilee was where the the towns and the villages on the west side were primarily where retired Roman military personnel had retired after their service. The emperor was able to keep them in a region to call them back into service. And so it was an area that had hippodromes and, you know, racetracks, and it had a Greco-Roman emphasis, and it was just a much more enjoyable lifestyle for a young man. But the fact of the matter is that measured by the number of miles that the prodigal traveled, it was not many miles at all, but it was a journey that was far removed from where his life had previously been grounded. And it was only as he came into the understanding of what he had lost and given up that he came back in apology, not even asking to be taken back home, but even to be treated as a servant. It was the graciousness of the Father. And by the way, the story is often entitled the story of the prodigal son, but it is more appropriately the story of the loving father who brings the son, the prodigal, back into the home. I've rambled there a little bit, but only because I think I was trying to differentiate that not every journey that we take is a pilgrimage, and I don't think the prodigal son, he might look back on it as life lessons learned, but I don't know that it was a pilgrimage. Sorry if I rambled on a little bit too long there.
No worries. John, did you want to add to your question?
Yeah, it was a typo, but what I was asking, aren't we all really pilgrims? Isn't the desire we have to go home again, the desire you just talked about, the desire to find ourselves, and that means we're really on a pilgrimage?
Sure, and I think it's important to understand that I'm going to be mentioning this in just a little bit. So Bunyan's book, A Pilgrim's Progress, is not the story of a person who's taking a geographical journey, but taking a spiritual journey home and to where he belongs. So the answer is, you know, it is yes. We all are on pilgrimages, but we need to understand that, for instance, some people can try to answer the questions: who am I? Where did I come from? Why am I here? Where am I going? Without any reference to God. So I don't know. They may be on a quest, but I don't know that they're on a pilgrimage. But if, John, if what you're asking is, does a pilgrimage have to be a physical journey? I don't think so. One of a little book that I was reading recently by a dear friend of mine, Dick Morgan, is entitled A Pilgrimage into the Last Stages of Life. And that, so the journey, those kinds of journeys can even change over time, in different times or aspects of our lives. Hope that was helpful and not just rambling.
I didn't mean to distract.
No, not at all. Not at all. And I'm happy to have questions at any time. It's important that we answer the questions that are being asked and not questions that aren't being asked. So, So going back a little bit to the history of pilgrimage, and I'll just move along quickly here. So there was a time in the early church where pilgrimages to Jerusalem were important, but then when the Crusades came along, the Holy Lands were closed off as a place of pilgrimage. But in the Middle Ages, as cathedrals were being built around Europe, then there were pilgrimages to the different cathedrals or holy sites that were other than the Holy Land. And it was during these Middle Ages, which was a time of chaos and disease and upheaval, there was a sense of when someone who lived in the Middle Ages and may not have traveled very far from their lives were somehow to be able to take a journey, and the place of the journey was a cathedral that was magnificent in its architecture and its beauty, its art and its expression, stained glass. It was something completely other than what was normally experienced in life. And so there were a lot of pilgrimages then that started taking place within Europe to places where miracles had been proclaimed or where cathedrals had been built. But also then pilgrimages became a source of funding for the church. And that a pilgrimage could be imposed as a penance, indulgences were to be paid, and monies that were given. And it was sort of a works righteousness thing of going on a pilgrimage and then you being rewarded or benefited from that act. So there was, in the Middle Ages, a sense of pilgrimage. The focus was no longer in the Holy Land, but it was around Europe. But then when the Reformation came along, Calvin and Luther were seeing pilgrimage as a manifestation of works righteousness rather than of sanctification. And so within the Reformation, pilgrimage began to be frowned upon. And Henry VIII decreed a law that, that priests could not send people on pilgrimages. But nevertheless, even though during the period of the Reformation and within the Protestant tradition, pilgrimages fell out of favor. But now, here in our current age, pilgrimages are becoming much more intriguing, perhaps I want to say to folks. And it could be for a number of reasons. Among them, simply to say, is that they are a lot easier and more convenient to do now than they were a long time ago. With passports and credit cards and air travel, we can be almost anywhere relatively inexpensively in a short period of time. And the pilgrimages may not end up being months in duration, but a week or 2 weeks in duration. But one of the other reasons I think that pilgrimages are becoming more popular, in addition just that they're more convenient, is that there is a sense of discipline that is associated with pilgrimage. We live in an age of instant gratification, where we want our food fast, and we want it cheap, and things happen for us instantaneously, and often at the push of a button. And I think that there is some sense of intrigue on our part of inviting a sense of discipline on a journey or travel that is different and may ask a little bit more of us than just a vacation might be. And that there is a desire for a soulful journey, and there is a desire on our part to know what it means to make sacrifice and to explore deeper questions of our life. I think one of the other reasons why pilgrimages are becoming popular again is it was the writer Houston Smith who said, we are embodied souls and we act out our faith in body, not just in mind and spirit. And I think one of the things that can be said about the Reformed tradition of faith and the family that Presbyterians are a part of is that we are most comfortable with our faith in our head. You know, we tend to be head oriented as opposed to a motive of the heart or but one of the things that pilgrimage does is because it involves the body as well as the mind, that we find that it begins to invite an understanding that is more than just in the head, but it can begin to incorporate the body and the mind and the spirit. And that pilgrimage becomes belief in action. And the body connects to the mind, and the mind connects with the soul, and the soul connects with the body. And I think that that can become one of the reasons why pilgrimage is becoming more popular today as well, because it includes our whole being rather than just a part of our being. So as I'm looking at the clock here, you know, time always goes by much faster than I think. But I know that I've spent a lot of time rambling over a lot of issues, but if there are any questions that people would like to ask, I'd be happy to.
There's a question here from the Dillies. I don't know if you guys want to unmute and pose your question.
I'm just thinking about the nature of a pilgrimage, trying to wrap my head around it. You know, the two questions I asked was about intentionality. Mm-hmm. And thinking about a silent retreat, you know, has mm-hmm. some of those attributes, but it may be next door to where you live.
Distance. Yeah. Well, you know, interestingly, my sister-in-law just came off of a 5-week silent retreat. But I think, and this is just off the top of my head because I'm not an expert in these things, but I think the two can stand apart from each other rather than saying that a silent retreat is a pilgrimage or that a pilgrimage has to take place in silence. I think they may be spiritual disciplines that are kissing cousins, maybe.
So with that, I'm going to stop the recording, but that shouldn't stop the questions. And I just want to say thank you so much for this really thought-provoking seminar. Connecting mind and body and spirit and soul.
I have a quick question.